Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint at WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. I'm going to keep taking you around the state and stopping off at wonderful places that are so very Vermont to explore. We've done downtowns, we've done covered bridges, we've done barns. Today, another favorite of mine, Vermont's country stores and general stores. Whether you're at Buxton's in Orwell, Courier's in Glover, or the Grafton Village Store, MKT, you're in a special place. We're going to learn about them today and reach out and speak to some of the owners of these stores and hear about community groups who have rallied to bring back the stores in their towns. Here to serve as our guide through the hour is Ben Doyle. He's president of the Preservation Trust of Vermont. Ben, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks so much, Rick. It's great to speak with you again.
Yeah, it's always great to have you. Now, listeners, if you'd like to ask Ben a question or if you want to share a favorite country or general store with us, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can let us know maybe it was a great part of your youth or has been a fantastic part of the community. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Ben, I use the terms general and country store somewhat interchangeably. I'm not necessarily sure that I'm correct. Is there a difference, or is it just a matter of what a particular store names itself?
Oh, that's a great question. Actually, I'm not sure I'm going to weigh in on that one. It's kind of like the difference between a groundhog and a woodchuck. It really depends on what you're thinking about.
Uh-huh.
I think they're both interchangeable, and you know, I would say probably a general store is more what we think about, the kind of historic store that carries a little bit of everything for everyone. But I think that either term really works.
All right, good. Now, I can guess that in your role, you've been to a number around the state. So first of all, what are the similarities of these, stores, these, you know, community stores that tie them together?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think of, at the Preservation Trust of Vermont, or, you know, our job, we're a nonprofit organization that works to preserve the essential character of Vermont through the historic built environment. And that's a way of saying that we really work with communities to help save the places that they love. And when you think about general stores or country stores, you know, they're kind of those iconic Vermont buildings that are like churches or schools. They're really, both literally and figuratively, at the center of communities. And, you know, they're often in the villages or downtown, so they're an important part of the built landscape. But I think even more importantly, we just know this, that they're central to the community, right? They're the kind of places where you go and everyone is welcome. There's something for everyone. And it's the kind of place where you run into your neighbor and meet new neighbors and have conversations that you might otherwise not, you know. And I think particularly today, when all of us are, you know, so often kind of doing our own thing, it's really important to have, you know, my predecessor, Paul Bruin, who founded Preservation Trust, used to refer to general stores as a third place, right? It's the kind of place where everyone can kind of come together and meet one another. And they obviously play a really important role in the economy of a community, not just for the local wealth that's circulated through the transactions that happen at the store, but, you know, in the fact that they often carry local goods, local produce, you know, that, and they become a kind of place where, you know, if a community doesn't have a locally owned store, doesn't have that central hub, it can be challenging sometimes to form that sense of community. So a place with a store often attracts people or keeps people there because of the sense of community it creates.
And then, so that's the similarities. How widely do they vary?
Oh, I think, you know, you know, there's a favorite expression of mine is if you've seen one small town, you've seen one small town, right? And I think the same thing goes for general stores, that, you know, they do have similarities, but each one of them has its own kind of unique quality that makes it special for that community. And, you know, and that's the difference, right, between a Vermont general store and, you know, a box store, where you could be in the inside of a box store and ask yourself, where am I? Am I in Cleveland right now, or am I in Vermont? But when you're in a Vermont General Store, there's really something about that community, the people that frequent it, the things that they sell, that really say something about that community. And I think that's one of their strengths, is that they tailor to their customers. You know, that a general store that's going to be successful has to know its customers, have to know what they want, you know, what the locals are asking for, and are often very responsive. So, you know, I think really each one of them is different based upon the kind of the community that it's in.
Well, let's talk about, you know, what they carry, you know, the items that tend to be common to all of them, and then some that fall out of the norm. I can remember, yeah, when I first got here, you know, and you say you were going to a certain town and somebody would say, oh, they have, you know, that general store in that town, you can get your ammo there or your Carhartts there, right?
Right. Yeah, you know, that's actually, I mean, honestly, as we're talking about, one of my favorite stores is Dudley's in East Montpelier,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's the kind of store, I think a lot of the stores, you know, all of them kind of have a beer cooler in the back. Most of them you can buy worms for fishing. At Dudley's, you can buy pretty much everything. You know, you can buy all your fishing equipment. You can buy hardware there. You can go to the deli. But again, I think, you know, most of them carry the kind of staples that they know that all community members need, right? Whether that's a gallon of milk or, you know, again, a beer cooler in the back. But then some of them also have, like, you know, selection of, you know, finer foods to cater to different customers. And, you know, again, I think that's what's really hopeful about the future for general stores, is their ability to be responsive and respond to the needs of their customers and to know their customers.
Well, you know, you mentioned the economic role, the social role. There's also the emergency role. You know, we hear some stories about when, you know, a town is in trouble. It might be Tropical Storm Irene, or you've got someone in the community who at 11 o'clock at night needs something, you know, and who do they call? It is the owner of the general store who's ready to jump into the fore there.
That's so right, and I think we've really seen that in COVID too, right? The ability mm-hmm. of general stores to be responsive and protect their community members, but also be responsive to their needs, whether that's being, again, an information hub or, you know, staying open so that people can get needed supplies, or even, you know, being a meal site, right, where folks can pick up meals through different programs to help people in challenging situations. And so, you know, again, I think it's just that these general stores can't survive without the support of their community. And I think that the proprietors of these stores know that, and as a result are really tuned in to what the needs of the community are and are there as a resource.
Now, Ben, when I showed up in Vermont in 2003, there were some Vermont-made items, and I know, like, at certain of these general stores, you could get, for instance, Ben and Jerry's Factory Seconds for, like, $1.99 a pint, which was phenomenal for somebody coming from away and seeing this. It was unbelievable, mind-blowing. Now the list, especially in the food and drink realm, has exploded of Vermont-made items. So how is having so many locally made goods affected what stores stock and what customers look for in these stores?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. You know, I can think of Pierce's General Store in North Shrewsbury. You know, that's a fantastic, it's actually a cooperative model in the town. And, you know, they have carried, you know, the store has been around for, you know, over 100 years, and they have carried the basic staples. But, again, they've been really responsive in the sense of when people come in and ask for something, you know, they make sure that they can stock it. And they also, you know, expand the offerings to have people try things that maybe they haven't seen before. And so, you know, I think that you know, we're so big about buying local in Vermont, but it's also a great opportunity to not just buy local, but to just think local and live local, right? And mm-hmm. to really understand where your food's coming from, supporting your neighbors as part of a local economy and a whole kind of ecosystem that the general stores play a really key role in.
Well, the other thing is when we, you know, you and I love the idea of exploring locally, too, right? Of getting out and seeing these wonderful towns, you know, whether you're a member of the 251 Club or not, you know, getting out to get to Barton, you know, getting out to Goose Green or wherever, you know, you can get yourself to in Vermont and learn about it. And we don't have, you know, big roadside areas, you know, with fast food places. So the general store plays an incredible role as you get out and explore Vermont.
Absolutely. You know, and it's, I mean, I that's probably the best part about my job, frankly, is getting out on the road and meeting people and seeing the exciting things that they're a part of. And, you know, I have to say, I'm one of those people that anytime I pass one, I stop, you know, just to get a cup of coffee or, you know, some ring dings or something like that. I always find a reason to just kind of stop because it's just such a great place to plug into a community and to see what, you know, what people care about in their town. And it's just a great place to visit with people.
Yeah. And you never know, you walk into a place like the one in Addison there that does some great smoking out front, you know, and you get smoked pepperoni or brisket, and you go home and you think, oh my God, how could I have passed that store before without not going in there? Right.
Right. Well, and the problem is you can't pass it again without stopping.
That's right. Yeah, totally got it. And we're now going to add another voice to the conversation for a few minutes. Emily McClure is one of the owners of the Craftsbury General Store. Emily, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Listeners, to speak to our guests, you can, or tell us why you're a fan of General Stores, you can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Emily, why and when did you buy the store in Craftsbury?
I moved from, well, I grew up in Orleans, in the Northeast Kingdom here. I grew up there, and then I was living in Los Angeles, and had been there for about 10 years. And, you know, my mom always said, you're just torn. You know, I had this love for the energy of cities, but really felt so connected to my birthplace and home. And so found, you know, my dad had pointed out this store years ago, and it came up on the market. And, I was just so captivated by the community. It was going to be close to my family, and, you know, felt like the business challenge was there.
I so love that your two places on earth are the Kingdom and L.A. who are your business partners in the venture there in Craftsbury?
So I brought on, hired Kit Basem right 3 months after I opened the store in 2012, and she became a partner in 2016. And then we brought on Jana Smart in 2000. Just this last year, she became a partner, but she's been with us since 2013.
Wonderful. How have you changed the store since taking it over?
You know, I think we just landed at the moment that our community was also kind of having this resurgence, and you know, the school was and still is, you know, Craftsbury Academy is just known for its great education system, and, you know, K through 12 all in one school system is not you're not seeing that a lot anymore, so that's been a huge part of it. But I think we just kind of got in at this moment. Sterling College was doing a bunch of great stuff, the outdoor center, the ag community here is really strong and robust, and so we got in and just kind of started to ride that wave and ask customers what they wanted. And, you know, I think that's been our greatest success, is just trying to hear when somebody says, can you bring in, you know, patchwork bread, or can you bring in sweet rowan milk, or my kid really loves that granola bar. That has been, I think, our greatest success.
The sweet rowan cheese curd is something I could not live without, by the way. Ben, how important is it for a town like Craftsbury to have a general store as a meeting point for its residents and to have access to the staples and to those local products?
Oh, I mean, I think it's really critical. You know, I think it's, you know, and when you visit the Craftsbury General Store, you can see that. It's a great kind of mixing place for everybody in the town, you know, and just the, you know, just the, you know, certainly there's the critical importance of, like, not having to get in the car and drive 20 minutes to a larger grocery store to be able to pick up just basic staples. But just really to have that opportunity to run into your neighbor. I think really, you know, you can't say enough about that, to kind of stand in line at the deli when you're ordering that sandwich and have a chance to have a conversation. You know, that's what really community building is about in a lot of ways, is these kinds of chance encounters that we have. And if these places don't exist, then you don't have as many opportunities for that to happen.
Yeah. Let's take a call. We've got Stephen joining us from Montpelier. Hi, Stephen. Go right ahead.
Hi, Rick. I have a question for Ben.
Mm-hmm.
And that is whether, I think the Preservation Trust has been instrumental in restarting several general stores in Vermont. And I think the one in Barnard comes to mind mm-hmm. in particular. I wonder if he could speak a little bit about the role of the Preservation Trust in restarting general stores.
Great. Thanks, Stephen, for that question. Go ahead, Ben.
Yeah, thanks so much. You know, I think what we have historically offered a support to a lot of general stores, including, as the caller suggested, helping restart ones. And that's really, we basically try to meet communities and stores where they are, right? What is the goal of this store? Has it closed? Is it in danger of closing? And are there ways in which we can support the store? And, you know, the primary model that we've used is what's called a community-supported enterprise model, where we help community members form a nonprofit trust to help raise donations to either purchase a building or renovate a building. And then by forming that nonprofit structure that can allow for tax-deductible donations, you can get the kind of infrastructure of the building in place and then rent it out to a for-profit operator. And that just gives them, you know, it changes the market dynamic a little bit so that the business can, you know, pay probably a reduced rent in order to, you know, make the building cash flow and be successful. So, you know, we've been a part of that model in a number of different places, including, you know, the East Callis store, the Barnard store, Elmore Community Trust right now is working on that, the Albany General Store. And, you know, it's not a model for everyone, but we think that, you know, the market for these stores is very challenging, right? And so we know that community members love them. We know that they're important to Vermont and to the character of Vermont. And, you know, this has proven to be a pretty successful model in giving them more space to be successful. And so, you know, we're often meeting with communities about this and are happy to provide our assistance and advice to any community that's facing this challenge.
Thanks for that call, Stephen. Emily, we just heard Ben mention the Albany General Store. I think you're involved with that as well.
Yeah, we really can't thank the Albany Community Trust and the Preservation Trust enough for the hard work and dedication they put into this. Ben just alluded, these projects, you know, they're not, if you have to do all the construction, the purchase, they're not, they're really hard to be viable. The overhead, just kind of walking in the door, is just too much for, I think, an owner to bear, you know, especially in the very beginning. So this has really just been a perfect marriage for us. You know, Albany Community Trust and Preservation Trust really held it all together, built the build out of the store, and we partnered with them in terms of, you know, building out the kitchen the way that we wanted it, and the store the way that we wanted it, and holding that vision for the community room that's going to be there, and that feels really important to the Albany community. So we're thrilled. We're opening June 3rd, and, you know, Albany's been without their store, I think, for almost 9 years. And, you know, I'm assuming the post office is probably overrun with a lot of chatter in there, and that's a pretty small little post office. So we're just so excited for folks to be able to come and get, you know, a gallon of milk, say hi to their neighbor. Jana's got an amazing, fun, home-style menu coming out of there, and, we're thrilled.
And as of June 3rd, bring the chatter on over to the Albany General Store. That's where it'll be taking place. I'm sure the folks in Albany can't wait. I want to get back to your Craftsbury General Store for a little bit. Tell us about your globetrotting dinners.
Yeah, this is, we always kind of call this our accidental genius. you know, I guess it's been eight and a half years ago, we decided to have a meal on Wednesday nights that we wanted to have the freedom to kind of switch it up each week. And we've certainly learned through the years, you know, we started off with some pretty labor-intensive menu options and have since, you know, found our system and moved through it really well. But we serve a different cuisine each week from a different place in the on the globe. And it's a takeout meal, around $13. And, you know, in the heat of the pandemic, we were doing 250 meals every Wednesday. I will be back there for the summer, which is insane when we're talking about a town with a population of 1,200 people. And it's been a super fun adventure for us. And Kit and Jana have really, and Jana especially now, really have, like, just nailed the system. And it's just, I think it's fun for us, and it's really fun for the patrons to just try something new each week.
I think you've recently had one of my favorites. Maybe it was even last night, Chicken Marbella.
Oh, yeah, it was so good.
that one little gasp said it all, how delicious that dish is and what you serve there. What are some other special events that the store puts on?
Well, I mean, I think we helped start our block party early on, and that was teamed up with, you know, there's two stores in Craftsbury. There's the Craftsbury General Store, and there's the Sea Village store across the street. And Christy and I have always had really a great working relationship. You know, they have creamies. We don't. We do our dinner on Wednesday. They do theirs on Friday. And we really wanted to kind of, like, showcase that relationship and the teaming up between us and Pete's. Now the Outdoor Center is involved in, you know, a number of organizations. But really, it started off with two stores closing down a couple streets and having a big old party for our community, which was a free meal that generally was on July 3rd. Of course, the pandemic has taken a pause for a couple years on that, but we're hoping to, you know, bring that back this year. So that's a big event for us.
And Emily, how else has the pandemic impacted your business? And, you know, how do you change to meet the needs of the community during it?
Yeah, it's been a really, I don't know that we knew how much grit we had, you know, until we were in it. And I think so many businesses have been in the same position where you just had to pivot. We've got Matt Allen on our crew, who's just really an IT genius and just so great with our point of sale system. And so he was able to help us launch our online store, which worked with our point of sale system, which was key for us to really get folks their groceries in a way that felt safe for them. So we offered a lot of curbside throughout the whole pandemic and still offer it for those that it's, you know, the working parents that are like have 10 seconds at lunch to throw in order. They can just swing by and pick up the bag. That works for folks. And so I think it's just made us kind of evaluate the things that maybe we knew that we had capacity or didn't know we had the capacity to do prior to the pandemic. And so it's been a fun adventure.
All right. Emily McClure is one of the owners of the Craftsbury General Store. I know it's always busy there. Thank you so much for spending time with us this morning, Emily.
Thanks so much, Rick. And thanks for all you're doing out there, Ben.
Yeah, Ben will stay with us from the Preservation Trust of Vermont. And when we come back, we're going to learn about what's going on in East Calais. Listeners, you can still join the conversation, 244-1777, 877-291-8255, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. I've got Ben Doyle of the Preservation Trust of Vermont with me this hour. And now we're going to bring in Mark Mahaly. He's the chair of the East Calais Community Trust. Mark, great to have you on Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks. It's great to be here with you.
Good. And listeners, if you've got a question for our guests or if you want to tell us about what's happening in your town, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Mark, give us a little history of the general store there in East Callis.
So the general store was built in 1850. It's probably the oldest, if not the oldest, general store in Vermont that's been continually operating, and we're really lucky in that they never destroyed its beautiful historic porch and facade. The store really served as the linchpin of the community of East Callis, which is on the Route 14 side of Callis, for many years, but it closed a year and a half or 2 years ago. And so, you know, Preservation Trust really pioneered an approach to these stores. These stores are the key to village centers. We really love the landscape of Vermont, and the landscape of Vermont is historic because of the villages, and villages need a store at their center for a community gathering place. This store served that.
So tell me about your organization now, the East Callis Community Trust.
Right. As Preservation Trust, as I said, pioneered this approach to preserving these stores. The problem is that, as Ben may have already explained, you know, every time somebody wants to sell a building or somebody gets tired running a store, it goes up for sale and disappears as a store, becomes a single-family home or whatever. So if you want to preserve these stores, you need nonprofit ownership where they are really, the stores are, the nonprofit owners make sure the stores stay as stores. So we formed the East Callis Community Trust. With a little help from Northfield Savings Bank, we raised the funds locally to acquire the building, which has three low and moderate income apartments in it as well. And now we're raising the money to renovate.
So tell us about the future plans that you have for the building and the general store.
Well, the building, imagine an 1850 building where people just added sewage, plumbing, electricity, and all the modern stuff.
Sounds exciting.
But they did it in the most haphazard and cheapest possible way, and it's all fallen apart.
Oh.
So it's really a gut job. And it's going to take a lot of money, and we've had a lot of help from the Vermont Housing and Conservation Board, from the state of Vermont, and from the Preservation Trust to raise the money necessary to do it. So we hope to go out to bid sometime in the next few months and be under construction at latest by the very beginning of the year so we can open the store and the apartments, but really get the store open in the late spring as a soft opening and a complete opening by early summer.
Mm. And why are these things important, this general store and these housing units to East Callis?
Well, the landscape of Vermont is kind of in danger. And, you know, our farmers are struggling and our villages are struggling. And in order to make this landscape work, well, of course, we have to help the farmers be successful. But we need these village centers to thrive. And I think a lot of people in the future, it's true we're worried now about people leaving Vermont, but a lot of people are going to be coming to Vermont, refugees from cities, climate refugees, and we want to encourage them to live in village centers. And in order to do that, the village has to be an attractive place to be. What's the point of having a walkable village if there's no place to walk to, no place to gather? And these general stores can have gathering places. We're putting in this store building. In this store, there will be a fireplace or a stove and a place to sit around in the winter and a deli and a place to be in the rest of the year, even places to sit outside. Village centers need that.
I've seen
the
plans.
And, of course, they need the food. When the store closed, all of a sudden the people of East Callis had to drive half an hour just to get to a supermarket, and the stores can provide keep these towns from becoming food deserts.
Mark, within Callis, I know Kent's Corner, I know Maple Corner, Adamant. I'm not sure I know East Callis very well, so tell us about your village.
East Callis is a village that's right on the eastern edge of the wonderful town of Callis. Mm-hmm. Callis is a beautiful town with Maple Corner and Curtis Pond kind of on one side, on the west side, and then East Callis is on the east side, and it is a village right off of Route 14. And the store, in fact, is on Route 14, which is a terrific advantage.
Ben, how important is it to see this grassroots effort by a community to make the initiative like we're seeing in East Calais to get behind a project like this?
Well, you know, we've just had an outpouring of support. East Calais is not a wealthy community. Its economics are more like the kingdom than, say, Montpelier. And it is amazing that we have raised just about $300,000 from the local community. People really care, and they've turned out and supported the store, and that support is going to be necessary continuing. These stores don't make a lot of money, and they need a real buy local sentimentality, and I think they'll get it.
And Ben, you had some input on that?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, I think what Mark has said is exactly right, and I also think it's one thing about redeveloping the store and making it the centerpiece of a village, as Mark talked about, but I think you can't say enough either about the social capital that's built through an effort like this, right? If communities coming together to save something, they're building social capital in that effort and putting their, shoulder to the wheel, so to speak. And when people come together to do a project like this, the project itself is important, but it's the skills and the capital that's built together that's also really, really critical. And, I just want to say, too, that, it's community champions like Mark and Emily and, folks around the state that are putting together these community trusts and working on these stores that are, they're just incredible champions for their community. They're savvy entrepreneurs, but they're really people who care about their community and should be celebrated.
I couldn't agree more. It's amazing how many people I've met that I didn't know through this effort. People come out and we're working together. When we, like Everyone Eats, which is a program that gives free food, Everyone Eats uses our store as a distribution point on Thursdays, even though the store isn't open. The Kellogg Hubbard Library uses our store as a distribution and pickup point. And, it's amazing. When you're standing there on a Thursday afternoon, people are just driving by and honking their horns and waving or pulling in. I think it really matters to a community.
And, Mark, was the East Calais Community Trust just formed for this particular project, the general store?
It was our first project. I think the trust is really interested in doing anything we can to revitalize the East and improve the East Calais community. This is our first project. It's really consumed us.
Yeah.
But I think when it's done, no, the trust won't go away.
And Ben, when I look at the plans for the general store there in East Calais, I see this historic structure with a new modern design and conveniences. So how important is it to make sure that these stores are staying current, changing with the times to meet modern needs?
Yeah, I think it really is important that the historic character of a place be preserved, right? Because that kind of that's a manifestation of our values and the authenticity that Vermont is really about. And yet at the same time, things can't stay locked in amber. If something isn't vital, it's dead. And so I think that there has to be a balance there between kind of preserving the essential character of the place, but also recognizing that needs of communities change. And, a building without people in it is just a building, right? And so if there are some changes that need to be made that don't, adversely impact the character of the place, then, I think that those are important to consider to ensure that the building truly is vibrant and bringing people together, because that's really what it's about.
Yeah, Rick, you can have it both ways, too, because, for example, the East Calais store will be a beautiful when we're done with it, it will look like the store when it was built in 1850 beautifully. But inside, it will have the most energy efficient appliances, the most energy efficient heating and cooling. And for stores use an enormous amount of electricity with all those beer coolers and everything.
Right.
And that's a big cost. That's going to be much reduced. In our windows, we'll make sure the windows are both historic and energy efficient. You can do a lot in ways that preserve the historic character and at the same time have all the modern conveniences.
Well, Mark, I know I pulled you out of a meeting with the Trust, so I want to thank you so much.
A pleasure.
Mark Mahaly is the chair of the East Calais Community Trust. Mark, thank you for being on the program.
Rick, thanks a lot. And Ben, take care.
All right. Best of luck with that project. Yeah. And Ben, I Jericho Center Country Store is one of my favorites for several reasons. It's got that historic charm combined with outstanding service. There's still the penny candy that you scoop out, delicious milkshakes. There's cookies, sandwiches. They still have these old post office boxes from back in the day. There's a sign from a basketball game, a score from probably, I think, in the 20s. And my favorite Vermonter of all time, Ben, is Snowflake Bentley, who lived nearby in Nashville Village. So every time I go in, I think this is where Snowflake shopped, right?
You know, I got to tell you, Rick, I did the same. It's, there's the historic marker right across the street, right?
Yeah.
Memorializing Snowflake. So, yeah, that's a fantastic store. You know, and that's one, again, I think that's been really responsive to the community and serving up some great food. But still having a little bit of something for everyone.
Now, I know there's one that you worked on, the Preservation Trust, and I love that I think they still do, but for years they had Wilcox's Ice Cream, which is from here in Vermont, that they'd scoop. It's right next to Silver Lake, and that's down in Barnard.
That's right. Yeah, that's actually one, you know, that, again, my predecessor, Paul Bruin, who led the trust for 40 years, was really deeply involved in and helping them, again, form this kind of model of the community-supported enterprise. And, you know, if I could just say one quick thing about that, too, that I think one thing that Mark mentioned in the previous segment that's really important is, you know, often these community trusts start with the idea of saving the general store, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, when that project is done and they've identified an operator, you know, usually a for-profit operator that's going to run the store as a business, then you still have that organization in that capacity that can do other revitalization projects or preservation projects in a community. And I think that's a really great additional outcome that comes from this. And then the other thing I just wanted to quickly say, too, is, you know, we hear a lot in the field of like community and economic development about the challenges around housing in Vermont. You know, finding affordable, quality, safe housing in our villages, particularly in our rural communities, it can be really challenging. And so, you know, the fact that the East Calais General Store is going to have a housing up above.
Yeah.
Really, really, really important. And I think we're going to see, frankly, I hope we'll see a lot of that in these kinds of really large general stores that often had apartments up above, and to see a kind of resurgence of that to make sure that it's safe and affordable.
Yeah, I remember when Richmond, the folks at On the Rise built that building down by the river there, and they included a couple units of affordable housing upstairs as well. I thought, oh, how brilliant. This is exactly what we need to do. Well, Ben, what do community groups need to do to start the process that you've seen in Barnard, that you've seen in East Calais and Albany and other places?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. You know, it really depends on, obviously, you know, where the community is in terms of, it has the store closed? Is it in danger of closing? And, you know, what PTV does, or Preservation Trust, what we really try to do is just be a friend to these organizations, right? To, mm-hmm. to help counsel them, to think with them, to connect them to other people that have been in similar situations, and then to provide support when we can. So usually what it starts with, Rick, is, you know, what's the status of the store? What's the status of the building? Typically, we might provide some modest grant funding to do a building assessment, you know, bring in a historic preservation expert or a building expert that can do a structural assessment of the building to really understand, okay, what are the capital needs of this building? You know, then we think with people often about what's the right ownership structure. You know, oftentimes keeping it in private ownership is ideal, but if that's, you know, not feasible given the needs of the building, you know, is there a co-op model that might work? Is, what about a community supported enterprise model? Again, which is this nonprofit side. And then, you know, often we in places like, the East Calais General Store, the Elmore, community store, mm-hmm. the Preservation Trust, it serves as a fiscal agent, right? So that we can, receive tax deductible donations on their behalf until they achieve their own independent 501c3 status. You know, that's the difference, right, between, doing that and starting a GoFundMe page or something like that, which are not tax deductible donations. So, you know, what we try to do is help them put up the structures that will help them be successful over the long term. And then we often work with them to connect them to grant funding sources, whether it's through the Preservation Trust programs that we manage or other state and federal programs that might be able to bring in financial support to help either in the renovation or purchase or even just sometimes equipment. Everything we can do to help make the business model viable moving forward and to give community members an opportunity to engage in that store, to really feel, you know, in some cases, a literal sense of ownership over the store.
I'm going to take us to Floyd's and Randolph Center. I mentioned it was the last place I've seen that big round of Cabot Cheddar, but they also have a sign on the message board that reads, "Post no politics, campaign posters. They will be used for cow betting," which is perfect. And yet they have this circle of rocking chairs there at Floyd's where townspeople come in and discuss politics every morning over coffee. Is there another place that you want to talk about, the quick shout out that you love going into?
Well, you know, I mean, you said we were going to wax poetic. So, you know, one place that I have to give a shout out to, one of my favorite stores, probably because I grew up down or up the street from it, is Aldrich's store in West Burke, which has been owned by the one family for years. And it is just a fantastic store. You know, West Burke is a small village up in the Northeast Kingdom. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, growing up in Sutton, West Burke had probably four general stores, I think, at one time, all active. And, you know, many of them have closed, but Aldrich's is still there. And it's the kind of place where you can go in there, you can buy toys for your kid. They've got a deli, you know, it's just that archetypal general store, you know, with a squeaky floor and all of that. And I just want to give a shout out to those folks. They've been working hard for years to keep that place open as a real center of community in West Burke. And if you get a chance, if you're headed up to Willoughby Lake, do stop by. It's a fantastic place.
Brilliant. Also in the kingdom, Couriers and Glover. Now, I know it's been sold and all the taxidermy is gone, but they had more taxidermy per square foot than anywhere in the world. There's Buxton's in Orwell. Great sandwiches. It's right there on that classic green. When you want to use the restroom, they give you a key, and you have to walk down the block to the old gas station. One more. It's kind of more of a department store. Maybe it's what you'd call a country store, but when you're down in Dorset, H.N. Williams store in Dorset, it's got a massive selection of Carhartts. It's got all kinds of Vermont-y products and just a wonderful stop. So, gosh, we could go on and on like this, Ben, with all the places.
We'll have to take it on the road.
That's right. That's right. We'll have to. Maybe we'll do a morning from Aldrich's there in West Burke. It'd be a lot of fun. Wade, real quick from Corinth, let's see what we can do. Go ahead, Wade.
How about what is your contact again?
For Ben at the Preservation Trust. How did they get in touch with you?
Yeah, they could. We have a website, ptvermont.org, and all of our contact information is there.
All right, excellent. Thanks so much.
Preservation Vermont?
PT Vermont.
Trust of Vermont. Yep.
Oh, just PT Vermont.
Yep.
PT Vermont.
Okay. All right. Yeah, we've got a project over here that may or may not fall into that category. It's the store that was kind of the centerpiece in the movie of Beetlejuice.
Oh, yes.
But it's unfortunately terribly dilapidated and under some unfortunate ownership, and it's not active right now, and I just don't know if it ever will be, but the options are on the table.
All right. Great. Thanks, Wade. We're going to save one in Corinth. That's great. Ben Doyle, president of the Preservation Trust of Vermont, always great to talk to you. Thanks so much for taking on this tour today.
Thanks, Rick. Really appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. When we come back, we're going to talk about solar with the folks from Green Mountain Solar. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. We hear a lot about renewable energy and the goals that the state and the country have, and those are important to discuss. But where do you fit into all that? How would you be able to make the switch to a renewable energy source at your house? I thought it would be good to take it to that micro level today and talk about what a switch to solar might actually look like and require if you decide to go to that route. And so joining me right now, we have two of the staff of Green Mountain Solar in Williston. Jane Stromberg is their outreach coordinator. Jane, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Thanks so much for having us today.
You're welcome. And Marcus Shapiro is their senior solar advisor. Marcus, thank you for being here as well.
Yeah, thank you for having us, Rick.
You're welcome. And listeners, if you have a question about converting to solar, this is the time. Give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. But you've got two people who can answer your questions. Jane, I'm going to start with you. First of all, give us an overview of Green Mountain Solar.
Yeah, sure. So we are a small local company located right in Williston, Vermont. And we're about 4 years old tomorrow, which is hard to believe.
Yeah. Happy anniversary.
Yeah. And so we offer an array of services, no pun intended. we do a lot of free educational site visits to, you know, folks' homes and businesses around the state, usually within a 2-hour radius of our office. And we offer, you know, roof, top and ground mounted solar array installations, as well as battery backup. And we also work with heat pumps and mini splits and things like that.
And Marcus, you know, how small to how large an installation will Green Mountain Solar get involved with?
We'll take on really, any size jobs. We work primarily with residential systems, but anytime a business reaches out as well, we're always happy to look into that, and we've been getting more into that. And there's various incentives available for both residential solar and businesses that make it attractive for really any size system.
And then how many people do you have on that technical side of the business, the installation side?
I believe on the installation team, we have about 10 installers at the moment. We just recently switched to 2 install crews for the first time as a company,
which
is very cool as our company grows.
Well, Jane, tell us, how big it, you said it's a small company, but you've already got 10 people on the installation side. So how big is the company and how has it been growing?
I do suppose we're about now closer to 20. You know, we've grown quite a bit in the past year or so. And, you know what? I guess it's not such a small company in the state of Vermont.
I think in Vermont, it's at least a medium-sized company.
Good point.
It's all perspective, isn't it?
It truly is.
All right. So, Jane, first of all, what are the benefits to installing solar?
So, that's the cool thing about solar, Rick, is that there are plenty of benefits to go on solar. The first one is obviously saving money, right? The whole idea behind, you know, going solar is to offset your electric bill. And by going solar, your electric bill, if you do choose to go the loan route, it gets replaced with a solar loan that is sometimes less than what your electric bill would have been, right? Another way to look at solar is as, you know, it's an investment. It's like rent versus mortgage. When you rent, you're not really investing in anything. It's kind of like money out the window. And with a mortgage, you're investing in something, right? And in the case of solar, it's a great home improvement, right? And it's an opportunity for free electricity once that loan is paid off. So that's one benefit, right? Saving money. And then another benefit is keeping energy generation local and in-state. That benefits not only the solar owner in terms of efficiency, but everyone really. Not sending our dollars out of state is truly good for the Vermont economy, and I think that's something a lot of people can agree on. And finally, I do want to bring up the environment. That's a huge aspect for folks going solar. It really helps to offset your carbon footprint and reducing those emissions, you know, therefore, you know, preserving the health of our ecosystems and environment in this state that we we look at as a beautiful state, and we want to keep it that way, right? So that's like a little overview of the benefits.
Well, Jane, you know, you mentioned that, so month to month, you know, my bill will be less because I've got, you know, this renewable source that I'm capturing, you know, but I do have upfront costs, so that has to be weighed. So, you know, how does it make sense financially for a household, and how do you help someone determine that?
So what we look at is your electric bill, right, in general, on average, how many kilowatt hours of usage you have and what those critical loads are. And then we kind of look at, you know, what your solar access is and if you're going to be able to generate enough electricity either on your roof or in your yard to offset that electric bill. You know, and we look at many different aspects of that. So Marcus gets a bunch of questions like these all the time, so I'm sure he can delve into that a little bit more than I can.
All right, good. Marcus, yeah, you want to pick that up?
Yeah, of course. So I will typically go around to about 8 to 10 homeowners a week and meet with them, and one of the first things we do is we take a look at their electric bill. And from there, we really look at their annual kilowatt consumption or how much electricity they use throughout the year, and then really see what their determining factor and motivation for going solar is, and then kind of delve into that. But then we kind of assess the whole property and see if they have a viable roof surface, whether it be south-facing, east or west, or if it makes more sense to look into a ground-mounted installation. And we take solar access readings there to determine the efficiency of the panels. And from there, how many panels we're going to need to install to offset, we typically shoot for 100% of the electric bill. And then really the idea is, as Jane mentioned, instead of paying an electric bill, which is money out the window, paying for a solar loan, which can very often, and depending on the loan you go through, be the same as or less than what your electric bill would have been.
So let's take, I don't know, a typical family of four, Marcus, and I'm going to say a house then with three or four bedrooms, a couple baths, you know. So you, I love that idea that you want as many panels as will meet their 100% of their usage. So in my scenario, how many solar panels would be needed to meet that family's needs?
So there's a lot of factors that come into play there, solar access being one of the big ones. So we determine how much shade there is versus sun there is on a particular surface. But for the average home in Vermont, we see right around the 8 to 10,000 kilowatt hour per year mark. And then from there, we determine based on the utility rates and the solar access how many panels we need. Mm-hmm. And I think our average company metric for kind of the average system size is in between like the 25 and 30 panel range is typically what we see.
And on a roof top, how many panels would fit on that house that I created that you can't actually see in this fake scenario that has so many other variables?
Yeah, so a lot of the times there can be dormers or skylights or roof vents, and all house roofs are built differently, pitched differently. And so at a site visit, if possible, I would hop up there with a ladder and get some really accurate measurements. And if we can't actually get up there, the site visit will use some programs where we can use satellite imaging to figure out exactly how many panels we can fit. And if we can't offset all of the electric bill with the roof-mounted system, or perhaps the roof isn't the ideal location, then we can look into a ground-mounted system as well, given the field space.
All right. Now, we hear this term, and I think this is your area again, Marcus, of net metering. What does that mean?
So net metering is really what makes solar possible in the state of Vermont. Obviously, our winters here, we have short days and a lot of snow, and so only about 10 to 20% of your yearly production is coming from the winter months. And so the idea is that we build the solar system to actually overproduce throughout the spring, summer, and fall. And as you produce more solar than what your house is consuming, the excess electricity goes back to the grid. It actually spins your meter backwards and builds you up a credit. And so the idea is that you'll build up enough of this so-called stockpile of credits throughout the spring and summer to last you through the winter months when the house is going to be consuming more electricity than the solar can keep up with.
And is the grid still happy to take the you know, the generated, the solar generated energy from my house back to the grid during those robust summer months, spring, summer, probably into fall?
Yeah, so we work with all the different utilities in the state, and all the utilities in the state do comply with the net metering, and we have to file a permit with the Public Utility Commission whenever installing a system. And this will detail the size of the system, the number of panels, and they'll make sure that everything's going to line up well and everything's going to function properly. There are some costs that can come up depending on the size of the system, such as transformer upgrades, which would fall on the homeowner. But that's all something that is figured out during the permitting process.
Marcus, the image of the meter actually spinning backwards, it makes me happier than anything I think I've heard in months. So I think that's kind of lovely. And we've got Stephen calling from Montpelier. Hi, Stephen. How are you? Go ahead.
Hi. I just have a quick question for your experts. I've been reading about solar shingles, and I was wondering if your experts could say a word or two about solar shingles.
All right, let's check. Who would know that, Marcus or Jane?
I would kick that over to Marcus.
Okay.
Yeah, I can touch on that a little bit. So the idea of solar shingles and solar roofing is still a relatively new idea in the solar industry. Companies like Tesla are really kind of lead the charge on that, as well as some other smaller companies in other parts of the country. In our opinion, there's still a little bit of gaps in the technology before it's really going to be accessible to a lot of homeowners. And there's also some challenges that come along in installation sides as well. Now all of your team needs to be cross-trained as both roofers, electricians, and solar installers. Mm-hmm. And so it's a larger project to take on. And at the moment, it really is quite cost inhibitive as well. It's really the cost of an entire roof replacement plus the cost of a whole solar installation as well. And if you're comparing it like that, even if you were to replace your roof and go with the traditional solar system, it's very likely going to end up being quite a bit less than the solar shingles. But we have been in conversation with Tesla to look into their solar shingle designs and are looking into that. And as soon as it becomes a more feasible technology and more accessible to homeowners, it's surely something we're going to look into doing as well.
It logically makes sense, but we'll wait for that day where it makes sense in every way. That's great. Thank you, Marcus, and thanks for the question, Stephen. Jane, what are some misconceptions about solar power and solar panel installations that you hear, and what are the answers to those?
Wow, we get a bunch of different questions. A lot of them range with, you know, will solar panels damage, you know, your roof? You know, how do we prevent leaks? You know, if squirrels are a problem, especially this time of year, I think it's on folks' mind because, you know, springtime, we're seeing a lot more animal activity. And another common question is, you know, if we'll need to cut down trees and things like that. So we get a lot of questions about stuff like this. Markets can definitely kind of go in depth, but as an overview, you know, we do everything in our power to prevent any type of damage. We actually are very, you know, careful about being invasive or anything like that to people's roofs or yards or anything like that. We want to kind of leave things almost better than we found it, right? Like we want to be as clean and as professional as possible. So we really do not try to, you know, we're doing everything that we can to prevent any leaks or anything like that. That's something that we get a lot of questions about because it's a valid question, right?
Yeah,
we get a lot of snow and storms and things in Vermont. But that is certainly not a concern for our customers. And I know Marcus can kind of go into a little bit more detail on that. And, you know, I might as well let him.
Yeah, Marcus, I'd love to know how those panels are installed on a roof that it's not, in effect, non-invasive and not damaging the roof.
Yeah, of course. So I actually started with the company as an installer. So I was up on the various roof surfaces installing for my first 6 to 8 months with the company. And we install solar on really any type of roof other than slate. And so it's a different type of attachment for different roof surfaces. And so we install on standing seam roofs, corrugated roofs, and asphalt shingle roofs all the time. With a standing seam roof, we use a standing seam clamp, which actually doesn't have any sort of roof penetration. And so you could actually take the solar off of the roof, and you would have never known that it was up there. And then for like a corrugated roof and asphalt shingle roof, which a lot of people have, we are making roof penetration. So we are drilling a lag into the rafter below the roof. And we use a aluminum flashing plate and then a 25-year warrantied caulking around our roof penetration. And then the flashing plate actually tucks up underneath the shingles above. And that way, any of the water is diverted below the roof penetration. And so we really do our best to make sure that we're not going to cause any issues to the roof down the line. Obviously, a roof is an expensive home improvement. And so if we were to damage it, that's really not what we're trying to do here. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, out of the hundreds of installations we've done, we've had just a few leaks, and it's something that we go out and repair right away. But it's really not something that we see very often, and we do our utmost care at the day of installation to ensure that that's never going to be a problem. And then as a company, we have a 12-year workmanship warranty. Mm-hmm. So we cover all of those roof penetrations as a company for 12 years to give the homeowner peace of mind that the installation is kind of a set it and forget it technology.
And Marcus, how is and how much energy, how is that stored and how much can be stored from a solar array in a home?
So this is talking about battery backup?
Yeah.
So that really ranges quite a bit. We work primarily with Enphase Ensemble batteries, and the Tesla Powerwall is the battery that most people are familiar with. And we really kind of size those batteries based on the usage of the homeowner and the loads that they're looking to back up. And so a lot of people do lose power for sometimes extended periods of time, and we can size a battery system to give them just a couple hours of backup, or we can size a system to give them a couple days of backup. And then asking those important questions of what exactly they want to back up. And for a lot of people, they're really just looking to do their critical loads. So to keep the water running, keep the food cold, and keep the lights on if the power does go out. And for a lot of people, we can do that with typically a single power wall or a comparable Enphase system. And then we have the great fringe benefit of the solar panels being able to continue production in the event of a grid outage.
Wow. All right. And I think this would be for you, Jane. We had a caller who wanted to know about if there's any incentives as far as for installing solar.
So we offer, there are quite a few incentives. I almost want to kick this to Marcus just because
okay.
He does kind of talk about more this a little bit more in depth with our customers day to day. And they just recently upgraded, but changed a little bit. So I feel like he's
okay.
A little bit more in the know with the nuances, if that's all right with you, Marcus.
Yeah, of course. So for residential solar, there is at the moment a 26% federal income tax credit. Mm. And so this essentially means you can recoup 26% cost of the entire investment of solar based on your federal income taxes. And so this all has to do with your income tax liability, but it's that 26% that really makes solar affordable and possible for a lot of people. It was actually scheduled to drop down to 22% this year, but there was actually some wording in the COVID relief bill extending the 26% for the next 2 years. There's also additional benefits for businesses as well. There are additional state tax credits, so a 6% state tax credit for businesses going solar, as well as accelerated depreciation that you can take on the investment of solar. And so we typically will tell homeowners all about these incentives, but then always say to refer to your accountant, because your accountant's going to know your situation best. And one of my favorite lines is, I know just enough about the tax situation to get myself in trouble.
All right. We don't want that to happen, Marcus, but that is great advice and a great incentive. So I hope that answers the question of our listener. Jane, there's been this talk of removal of trees, and I'm wondering if the removal of trees doesn't negate the positive environmental impact of installing solar.
That is a fantastic question, Rick. So we do get that a lot, and I studied environmental science for quite a few years, and I looked pretty deeply into this, and I'm a huge proponent of solar, and here's why. Trees comparatively have a 4% efficiency, and a solar panel is, you know, it's really efficient. I mean, trees and solar panels have similar technology if you think about it, right? A tree has its leaves with the chlorophyll. It's basically a bunch of little solar panels, but they're actually 4% as efficient as an actual solar panel that, you know, human beings can create. So if you're worried about cutting down a couple of trees to make room for that light to shine on your panels, don't be. It's really inconsequential compared to the benefit and environmental payback that solar panels actually have. So it's something that I've always felt a little guilty about, right, as a concept. Yeah. Oh, my gosh, I'm cutting down trees to just, you know, kind of help the environment. But how does that make sense? It really does if you work out the math and look at many different species in terms of their, you know, kind of carbon intake and how they actually impact the environment. So worry not is what I would say.
All right. And Marcus, what is the general timeline of installation of solar panels for a residence typically? If I came to see you today, when might I, you know, be harnessing solar power at my house?
So we typically have right around a 2-month lead time, and that lead time does vary throughout the year based on how many people are reaching out. This time of year, we're definitely a little bit busier. When the sun starts shining, it seems like everyone starts thinking about solar more often. And so we typically shoot to have right around a 2-month lead time. The permitting process for most takes about 11 days. But then with a go-ahead from the homeowner, we can really be out there to install the system and get it done in about 2 months of them giving us the go-ahead.
All right. And Jane, I think you touched on this early on, but talk about the area that Green Mountain Solar serves.
Yeah, so as I said before, we are located in Williston, Vermont on Commerce Street, and we typically do about a 2-hour radius from the office because, like I said, we have a quote-unquote smaller team, and that's our only office in Vermont, which is nice because, you know, we are that local company. But yeah, we don't go too like deep into the Northeast Kingdom, you know, way up northeast. But we try to kind of branch out as much as possible, but it's around the two hour mark. And Marcus knows that very well because he's the one driving.
All right. Well, Marcus probably knows, yeah, the full 2 hours, all around, Williston. I want to thank both of you. That's Jane Stromberg, Outreach Coordinator. Also, Marcus Shapiro is the Senior Solar Advisor for Green Mountain Solar in Williston. You can learn more. The website is greenmtnsolar.com. Thanks, both of you, for being here this morning.
Thank you, Rick. It was really great.
All right. Take care. We're going to hop out for a CBS News break. When we get back, we're going to meet the new Vice President of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at Norwich University. And tonight on WDEV, we're going to have Red Sox baseball. They're going to complete that 3-game series with the A's, try to pick a win up here. They have a 3-game losing streak going. Coverage starts 6:10, first pitch 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. To be first, there is great honor, great expectation, great respect, and great responsibility. And when someone is chosen to be the first, those making the selection will have seen a strength of character that is needed to weather the challenge of this new role. Recently, Norwich University made their selection for the school's first Vice President of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. And now we have the honor of meeting her, speaking with Dr. Julia Bernard. Dr. Bernard, thank you so much for being on the program this morning.
No, thank you so much for having me, Rick.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got
the opportunity.
Oh, excellent. Listeners, if you've got a question for Dr. Bernard about her new role at Norwich, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I know it includes nursing, child development, marriage and family therapy. Give us an idea of your background.
Sure. So, I went the traditional academic route. My degrees are in marriage and family therapy and child development and human development as well. And so, you know, most of my background in academia has centered around, again, growth and dealing with adverse childhood experiences and change, you know, a perspective of being able to grow and develop and assimilate change into one's life. And so, that's kind of been my academic upbringing, so to speak. But I've also had the pleasure of working in a diversity resource office, starting as a work-study student in my undergrad, and being the first chair of the diversity, equity, and belonging group in my college here at East Tennessee State University. Mm. And so it was new for us here as well. And so this is something that I've done before. And I look forward to the challenge of doing that at Norwich as well.
Why was this a position, the one at Norwich, one that you really wanted?
Well, I mentioned this during my interview process, but I've always kind of been drawn back to the military and military traditions. So currently, my marriage and family therapy practice, my private practice, I only serve veterans. I also do Give an Hour, which is an organization that donates therapy hours to active military members and their families. And, you know, again, we see the families in any configuration that they want to come to us. So, for example, if someone is having problems with their roommate or someone is having family issues with extended family members, they can come in any configuration that they want. And the VA doesn't offer those types of options. And so it's a great program to be a part of. I mentioned before to the people that I was interviewing with that we're a military family. I have a lot of Marines in my family. Hmm. One Army that married in and a Rogue Navy. but for the most part, we are a Marine family. And, you know, we're good Catholics. We have a lot of cousins that have served. And so, I always felt that this was my way of serving those who served us. And so, you know, I've always kind of been drawn back to serving military members. And so this is a neat combination of all of my experiences to be able to come to Norwich and utilize all the skills that I've been building all of these years.
It must be exciting around your house on Army-Navy Day like it is at mine. Now, Julia, I know you don't start in the role until July 1st, but what are your impressions of Norwich University and the Northfield community?
You know, I got the opportunity to come out and visit, and it was beautiful. It was what I imagined it would be. And it was early spring, and it was still warm enough that people were out walking around and enjoying the sunshine, which, you know, makes it that much more pleasant to do. One of the things that struck me was that everyone was very friendly. Everywhere that we went, I got to meet President Onorumo. He showed me around, and we stopped and talked to a lot of people. And they were all just very welcoming, and that was a fantastic response, I thought. Natural beauty that's in the area is obviously something that is a very big attraction for us. And so I was happy to just be in a place that felt like it was where I was able to breathe.
Nice.
It's not like visiting a city where, you know, you're worried about, you're clutching your purse and you're worried about, you know, crowds and you're worried about, you know, making it from point A to point B in a set amount of time. It was very relaxing to be in that community.
Julia, when I first moved here, I said to people, it's amazing. I haven't been in a traffic jam in 3 days. And that's kind of that space and that you're alluding to when you moved to Vermont from away. Let's go to Northfield. We have Lee calling. Hi, Lee. Go right ahead.
Oh, good morning, Dr. Bernard. It's Lee Hatch from Norwich University. I help coordinate your interview. So good morning. Welcome to campus. And my one of the questions that I have for you, Doctor, is once you step inside our campus, what are some of the things that you will look at to know what direction to take us?
Great. Thanks for that question, Lee.
Yeah, so I think, Lee, the thing that I look forward to most is to kind of learn a little bit more in depth about the programs that are already existing. So I know that they've made some really neat programming as far as empowering the students to help their peers through LEAP, again, Leadership, Education, Advocacy, and Protection. I know that there are courses being taught that have diverse content. So there's all of these little programs that have already been going on, the One Love Foundation, and I look forward to getting to know all of these things a little bit better. I'm not a fan of reinventing the wheel, and so I think that we can build on some of the existing programming that's there and just house it in one place, maybe build those things a little bit bigger and bolder as we move forward. There's a model of change by the Stanford Women's Leadership Innovation Lab that talks about small wins and this idea that, you know, the best way to, the evidence-based way to move forward is to make subtle changes that make a big difference. And you just take these small wins and you grow them so that you have programming that really makes a difference and really is part of the institution that you're trying to advocate for. So that's kind of what I'd like to do is explore what you're doing a little bit more in depth. I need to get to know the Norwich community and its policies and procedures. And then again, once we get all that information, we can start putting together some programming that makes sense for us.
Julia, the position is brand new, and thus the title might not be clear to people exactly what that role is. So I do want to take each aspect of the role, of the title, individually, and ask you to explain what they mean to you. And I'll start with the word diversity.
Sure. So, you know, diversity is one of those words that I think gets pushed around as a buzzword these mm-hmm. days. But the idea is that everyone is treated respectfully, and you accept people from different backgrounds. This idea that there's diversity of the people, there's diversity of thoughts, there's diversity of ideas, and it just means differing ideas. And so, you know, this idea that we can all be coming from different places and still have this experience together in an accepting way. So that's diversity. I think that, you know, I honestly, I gave this example of my grandfather. He was a farmer, and as a farmer, he had to rotate his crops. And, you know, the reason that we rotate the crops is because, you know, if you keep planting the same seed in the same spot over and over again and don't put things back into the soil, then it's not going to be as fruitful. And so you have to be able to put different kinds of nutrients back in and rotate the crops that bring a different element to that soil. And so, you know, using that example, I I'm the granddaughter of a farmer, right? I kind of relate everything back to farming, but this idea that we can put some things back in the soil by introducing diversity is something that I use to kind of explain why diversity is important. I think that we have to have that change in thought patterns, and again, not something that's going to be damaging to the soil, but something that's going to enrich it. Mm-hmm. And that's how I view diversity.
Now, the next is equity. And in the past, we've always used the word equality. I don't know how much difference there is in the two words, but the next in the title is equity.
Yeah, so, it's interesting. There's a meme that's out there that shows everyone getting the same box to look over a fence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a tall person, there's a medium-sized person, and there's a short person. Well, when everyone gets the same box, that's equality. But not everyone can see over that fence, right? So equity is a little bit different in that depending on who you are and what you need, you get what you need to be able to see over the fence. So the goal is to see over the fence.
Mm-hmm.
So it, it's a little bit different. So it's not everybody getting the same thing, but everyone getting what they need to reach the same goal. So that would be how I would describe equity.
That's a great way, a very clear way of describing it and the difference between, equity and equality. And the last is inclusion. So how do you see that manifesting itself with what you'll be doing at Norwich?
So I think inclusion is one of those really important things. I like to say that we don't have a conversation about somebody unless we have them seated at the table. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that that's really important. So if we're going to have policies, let's say, that affect minority staff members, then there has to be a staff member or two or three at the table, because they're going to have a different perspective than just administration, right? So this idea that we include people into the conversation, the policies that will affect students have to be discussed with the students. And that's not to say that we can't make, authoritative decisions from the top down. But I think the perspective of including their voices into the conversation is really important. So participation in what it is that's going to affect you is really important. So inclusion for me is that participation. It's finding ways to be able to implement different programs and procedures and policies that impact people with their voice included into that.
Dr. Bernard, what does it mean to you to be the first person to take this job on?
Well, you know, I think that it's interesting, as I was interviewing, in the Norwich tradition here, they introduced me to a few things that they've been part of that were first. They talked about the inclusion of women into the cadets and into the Corps, and the inclusion of, underrepresented groups. And so I think, once again, this is a historic move by them. And I think, I'm honored to take the position. I'm honored to be a part of such rich history and to expand on that history. And I hope to bring some of that history to light as I continue to learn more about Norwich and its past and to build on those conversations. I think, this is definitely one of those positions that I'm going to get a little bit of pushback, I think, as I put forth ideas, and that's going to be good for me as well. I think that, I'm coming from a state college in Tennessee, and it's different, a different set of rules and a different perspective to be at Norwich, and so it's going to be a learning curve, I believe, as well. And I look forward to that. Change can be a good thing. It's progress and it's growth, and I'm ready for it.
Well, as you probably know, Vermont is not a very diverse state. It appears open to fostering diversity. Some of our communities consistently step forward to welcome refugees from around the world. What can Norwich do to be more inclusive to a more diverse student body?
Well, I think there's lots of things that Norwich can do. I think, I'm aware that they are already taking some steps to have the desire to want to include a more diverse student body, and that's the first step is that want. And then, I think that opportunity is really the key for exploring different groups of students to appeal to. So, giving opportunities, like letting them come and visit the campus, letting them apply for scholarships, giving them the opportunity to work with some of the professors that are there. So those introductions are going to be key, right? I had a president that once told us that, every interaction with a student is an opportunity for recruitment or retention, just depending on where that student was. Mm-hmm. And I believe that to be true. And so I think that, again, having those conversations, introducing them to Norwich and all that Norwich offers is really key. And, again, giving them opportunities that maybe they couldn't find somewhere else. That is a way to appeal to some diverse groups.
And how do you see that diverse group benefiting the university and the state of Vermont overall?
Well, again, when you introduce new and different ideas, it often leads to innovation. So, you know, if we're not introducing new ideas, then we're not innovating. And so I think that that's really the benefit to Norwich. When we have new ideas and fresh perspectives and, you know, again, it allows for a vibrancy that maybe wasn't there before when we, you know, have this diversity present. You know, again, there's lots of different ways that we can improve the climate at Norwich. And I think that, you know, again, when we're introducing new students and they're going to have ideas on how that can be done as well.
Dr. Bernard, when you and I talk in a year and then in 2 years and 5 years, and I hope that is the case, what impacts will you have made at each point at Norwich University?
Well, you know, I think at year one, my hope is that we have continued some of the programming, the training, the interactions that have made Norwich successful thus far. I hope that we will have started to develop some programming to promote diversity, both in the student body, in the faculty, and in the staff. And then, you know, a little further out, I hope that we're collecting metrics and I'm able to give you an update on, you know, how we're continuing to bring transparency and accountability to those initiatives that we put forward to really show you the improvements that we've made.
And then in 5 years?
In 5 years, I hope that the numbers will reflect a growing diversity at Norwich. And I also hope that, you know, we will be known in the community as having these diversity initiatives going on and equity programming, and that people feel welcome at Norwich. That you know, it's part of the community in ways that make it seem like a cultural hub. That would be my hope for 5 years, that it kind of becomes a place that's known because it's accepting and it's got a lot of diversity and a lot of representation going on that really brings something to the community.
And how is a school like Norwich, with its core of cadets as part of the student body, a good place for the work that you'll be doing?
Well, you know, I think the military is one of the most diverse organizations in the country, and I think that often gets overlooked. And, you know, I had a vet tell me a story one time, and I shared this recently with President Onorumo, but, you know, again, they go into the military just very different people, but once they go into boot camp, they come out as one unit, and, you know, the differences go away. And I think that unity, that camaraderie, that all is part of, again, including all of those diverse people with one goal and moving toward one goal. And you know, at Norwich, it would obviously be an education, getting them all the education that they have sought out a university to get. But, you know, this idea that, you know, that it's harder or that it can't be done, or I think that's probably a misnomer with cadets or with military personnel, because I've seen them do it.
You excited for July 1st?
I am excited for July 1st, yes. Well, so we'll be up there a couple of times for house hunting.
Yep.
I'm excited to be back. It's a beautiful state, and I very much look forward to driving through it and getting to know it a little bit better.
Good. Well, congratulations and welcome to Vermont. Dr. Julia Bernard is the new vice president, the first vice president of diversity, equity, and inclusion at Norwich University. And we're excited to have you. So thanks so much for being on the program today. I know a lot of it is still kind of nebulous and plans until you get here and get running, but I really appreciate the time you've had for us this morning.
Well, thank you so much, Rick. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak to your listeners.
Absolutely. All right, you take care. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com, so please feel free to suggest guests or topics. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. We talked this morning about the general stores and country stores in Vermont, and we are sponsored. Our podcast is sponsored by another great one, the Warren Store. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next here on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.